in the living room of Loney and Paul Feitler's apartment at 444 Central Park West, the phone rings off the hook. It's April 1944. Their good friend Robert Bachrach has died unexpectedly, and the news is spreading fast. They let each questioning call ring. There's no way to tell if the caller is after news or gossip, but they'd rather not talk about any of it. They distract themselves, playing with their granddaughter, Kathy. But when their daughter, Elizabeth, gets home, they can't hide from her questions. She wants to know, what happened to Robert? A few weeks ago, he was in fine health, and now he's gone. Just a few short years after he finally escaped from Vienna to join his friends in New York City. And now she's starting to hear rumors. Elizabeth is right to suspect something. Eventually, Loney gets up to fetch a handwritten letter. She and Paul have been guarding the secret that Robert hoped to take to his grave. Welcome to Exile, a podcast from LBI, the Leo Beck Institute, New York. I'm Mandy Patinkin. When everything is taken away, then what? From LBI's archives, untold stories of Jewish lives in the shadow of fascism. In this episode, a tale of two men. One who escaped the growing hatred of humanity in Europe, only to see his new life in America crumble again. And one who stayed behind to save those who could not save themselves.
My mother's family was pretty wealthy and very assimilated.
Kathy Gay grew up hearing stories from her mother Elizabeth about life in Vienna before the Second World War.
They lived on the Schwarzenberg Platz in a big apartment. There were chandeliers. There was gorgeous furniture. It was a place of magnificence. And my mother went to balls. She went to the theater frequently. I know that she went to parties.
To support this opulent lifestyle, Paul Feitler, Kathy's grandfather, worked as an importer, making sure the coffee houses of Vienna were well stocked with the best coffee from Colombia. Kathy's grandmother, Loney, was a woman of society.
My grandmother had a salon every Thursday afternoon to which the intelligentsia, the artists, the musicians, the writers came and discussed everything from politics, books, music, to current affairs, whatever was going on and was interesting at the time.
The guest list was the who's who of society in Vienna.
I'm sure that Pierre Degorski, the famous cellist, played there. Heinz Reumann, the actor, was there. I am sure that Leo Hochner came. I would imagine that Robert Bachrach was there.
Robert Bachrach and Leo Hochner were dear friends of Loney and Paul, and both were voluncul, uncles by choice, to their daughter Elizabeth. Leo split his time between Budapest, where he worked as an industrial textile designer, and Vienna, where he socialized with his friends. Like many assimilated Austrian Jews of his generation, he had converted to Christianity, probably for practical reasons.
He was artistic. He could make ball gowns. He bred little dogs, dachshunds in particular, and he gave one to my mother. There's no way I can pronounce the whole name of the dog. It has four names.
The dog's name was Anna Mirl von Ausberg, but they just called her Mirly. Leo and Elizabeth trained her to offer Loney's house guests matches for their cigarettes. Leo and Mirly would accompany the family on summer escapes to their lake house.
My mother and grandmother and Leo were sitting around the lake. My grandmother was reading a book, and the book said something about belly dancing. And my mother asked Leo what belly dancing is. And Leo said, well, I can't really explain it to you, but I can show you. And up he stood and started to belly dance.
An exuberant bachelor, Leo fit right into Loney's Thursday salons. But to an outsider, Robert Bachrock might have seemed like a peculiar addition to this social set.
Robert was a well-known urologist in Vienna. He had a widespread, lucrative practice.
Robert was a studious doctor, committed to publishing his latest medical research. Perhaps not the type to spontaneously belly dance. But he, too, was a dear friend of Loney and Paul. Around them, he could relax and be himself.
My grandmother must have been very progressive because she knew that Robert was gay.
At the time in Austria, homosexual acts were illegal and punishable by imprisonment of up to 5 years.
But on top of the possible criminal proceedings, there was an enormous stigma attached to having a same-sex relationship. You'd lose your job, your family might turn against you, your friends, your reputation would be destroyed.
Lori Marhofer is an historian of queer and trans people in Nazi Germany. He explains that in spite of these dangers, if you ran with the right crowd, being gay in Vienna in the 1930s could also be very exciting.
Like other major European cities, Vienna had a queer scene from at least the late 19th century. Bars that had reputations, people were cruising in the park, but everything was undercover.
But after the Nazis gained power in Germany, word of their persecution of queer people began to spread across the border to Austria.
Berlin was probably the most open city in the world for queer people. There were bars in Berlin that were advertising openly. There were gay, lesbian, and transgender magazines. And when the Nazis took power in 1933, they closed all that down and revised Germany's criminal law about homosexuality. And then they sent the police after queer communities. It's a real change from a very open society to a very conservative society. The Nazi crackdown was something that people in Vienna would have known about and been concerned about.
Fear was starting to spread through all kinds of undesirable communities. What might happen if the Nazis gained power in Austria? But in spite of being Jewish, Elizabeth and Paul didn't think there was much to worry about.
My mother told me that neither she nor her father believed that the Third Reich could ever really come to be. This is the land of Goethe, the land of Mozart. This could never happen. My grandmother, Loney, on the other hand, saw the future.
Loney was vigilant about keeping the family's options open for a potential emigration, and she was right to be worried. One day, Loney's daughter, Elizabeth, was accosted by a classmate.
I had a classmate who came up to me one day, a girl whose name was Susie Reichel, and said, I'm going to kill you. And I say, tell me, are you crazy? I hardly know you. She says, no, but you are Jewish. You have to be killed.
Then, on March 13, 1938, the Nazis annexed Austria. Fortunately, Leo was already working in Budapest. That evening, Lonnie, Paul, and Elizabeth tried to escape as well.
They attempted to flee by train to Budapest to get to Leo. They were unsuccessful. They were turned back.
Life got difficult fast. Robert's medical patients began to fall off the radar, either fleeing or keeping to themselves. Lonnie's salons came to an end. But as Elizabeth explains, Paul's links to Colombia through his coffee business came in handy.
I always wore a Colombian badge. When one of the Germans talked to me, I answered him in Spanish. He didn't understand me and said, "Sorry, I didn't mean to bother you."
Eventually, Lonnie got word that someone was forging papers to reach Switzerland. They were expensive, but she handed over the cash immediately for her, Paul, and Elizabeth. No price was too high if it might save their lives. But then, nothing. As days, then weeks passed, they began to worry. Until one evening, 2 months later, Elizabeth got a phone call from the forger's wife when she was home alone.
And the wife said, "Come running. Don't waste a second. Come to the house immediately." My mother wrote a note to her parents saying where she had gone, running out into the street, which was exceedingly dangerous, got to the home of the forger, and went in and found the place in total disarray, the wife of the forger trembling like crazy. And the woman told her that the Nazis had come and taken away her husband and destroyed the apartment, pulled everything down, taken whatever they could. But the visas that were for my mother, grandmother, and grandfather were hidden, and they did not get those. The woman said, "Grab them, run, get out of here." And that's what my mother did.
The next day, Elizabeth, Lonnie, and Paul got on a train to Switzerland, with Leo already gone as well. Robert Bachrock was left behind. We can only imagine the fear and isolation Robert must have felt at this time as a gay Jewish man living under Nazi occupation. In April 1939, 11 months after they had escaped Vienna, Lonnie, Paul, and Elizabeth sailed on to the United States. But Robert remained in Vienna. Leaving was becoming harder by the day. Ever the professional, he kept his head down, working. As long as people were sick, he would continue to treat them. But even this was getting harder.
As the Nazis came more and more into power, he was only allowed to treat non-Aryans. And as a result, his practice became smaller and smaller.
In October 1938, Robert lamented his situation in a letter to Lonnie and Paul.
"According to the latest decisions, I am among those doctors who have been approved to treat non-Aryan patients. Whether I can be congratulated on this remains to be seen. But in any case, at least I am not condemned to twiddle my thumbs and would otherwise have been forced to accelerate my migration plans, which is almost impossible today."
Robert knew he needed to plan an escape, and quickly. More and more gay men were being brought up on charges under sodomy laws and sent to prison for engaging in consensual relationships.
Queer Jewish people that I have seen in the archive are much more sensitive to the idea that they need to leave the country as fast as they possibly can. And the queer Jewish people were right. They did need to leave the country as fast as they possibly could. And the people who did were much more likely to survive.
On July 6, 1939, Robert managed to get papers that would allow him to escape. He followed in the footsteps of his friends to Switzerland and then traveled to England. After a wait of a year or so, he boarded the SS Northern Prince, bound for New York. where Loney, Paul, Elizabeth, and countless other immigrants were waiting for him. When Robert stepped off the boat, he stepped into a new life. America, the land of the free, chock full of opportunity for talented emigres.
Robert Bachrach, when he arrived in New York, he stayed initially with my grandparents at Riverside Drive, where many, many Austrian and German Holocaust refugees settled.
He started to rebuild his life from the ground up. He opened a practice on Madison Avenue and once again began making good money. And he remained close friends with the Feitlers, even after moving to his own apartment. When Elizabeth gave birth to Kathy in 1943, Robert was smitten.
He was very close to my grandparents and to my mother. And the story goes that he also loved me. For a refugee who had resettled under very difficult circumstances, I believe he lived a good life for a certain amount of time.
But things didn't stay good forever, because Nazi Germany was not the only place in the world where being gay could be dangerous.
It's a matter of degrees of violence, but it's not a real difference in approach.
Same-sex relationships between men were illegal in every American state.
Those laws were enforced by the police, and being arrested or being outed in another way meant losing your job, your family, your career, your reputation. People were at great pains to keep their gay life separate from the rest of their life and to keep it private.
And just like Nazi Germany, the United States had a strong infrastructure for enforcing these laws.
Entrapping people in public restrooms was a way that the police in Germany went after people. And they did that in the U.S. too. Police officers would go into public restrooms and hang around and maybe even seem like they were flirting and available. And then if you made a pass at them, they would arrest you.
On a cold February afternoon in 1944, Robert walked into an NYPD trap. On his way into a subway station on Lexington Avenue, he stopped to use the restroom, where another man caught his attention. He was standing at a urinal. Robert approached to use the one next to him.
The defendant at the hour, about 3:20 p.m., while in the IRT branch of the Lexington Avenue subway line, did loiter in the men's toilet therein for a period of about 5 minutes.
The other man was an undercover police officer.
The defendant states he is in good health, is mentally alert, and answered all questions readily. Questioned as to habits or other evil tendencies, he admitted to the PO that at times he has uncontrollable homosexual impulses.
He arrested Robert on the spot.
Something drastic must be done to impress upon him that acts of this type and individuals of his class are a menace to society.
Robert was mortified. He didn't want anyone to find out what had happened. Loney and Paul were committed to helping him keep the secret.
The story I heard as I was growing up was that he had been in a local gay bar and he was caught by the police and arrested. Probably because it sounded less salacious than what really happened.
6 weeks later, Robert appeared before Judge Ramsgate for sentencing.
He was given the option to either pay a fine or spend time in jail.
Robert chose to pay the $50 fine, a sum equaling his monthly rent. But things didn't end there. Slowly, the news began to spread. Robert was expelled from the New York County Medical Society for moral turpitude. Within a few short years, Robert had lost his profession twice in two countries and for two different reasons. Weeks later, Robert was dead. We won't ever know what went through his head during his last months, but dated letters discovered with his body in April 1944 suggest he had been planning his death since the entrapment.
This is a farewell letter. It has always been, perhaps in the absence of another, my purpose in life to uphold the name and honor of our family. The fact that I haven't succeeded in doing this in the end shatters my heart, which was already afflicted with a crack, completely. Farewell and keep the memory of me from earlier times. Robert.
And then, of course, there was a letter for Loni and Paul, now preserved in the Gay Family Collection at the LBI Archives. By the time this letter arrived, Robert had overdosed on sleeping powder.
It was basically a suicide note. It was written approximately 2 months before he killed himself.
My dear Loni, my hour has come and I wish to appear even less ungrateful to you than to anyone else, for you have shown me such boundless kindness over these past years that I could never thank you enough.
It is this letter that Loni reads to Elizabeth now that she has come looking for answers. Baby Kathy sits at their feet, oblivious to the tragedy playing out overhead.
It was only because of you and Paul's and Elizabeth's attitude towards me that I was able to get through these last truly difficult years with my head held high. However, you have helped me even more with your deep understanding of my personal worries and with your never expressed and yet so clear sympathy for my longing for those who left me here alone.
In his final words, Robert revealed an even greater sense of loss and pain he'd carried with him for years. Someone he'd left behind and longed for.
If you ever see Leo again in your lifetime, tell him that I thought of him until the last minute of my existence. Robert.
Elizabeth is silent, her mind whirling, until she asks, is Robert talking about Uncle Leo? Were Uncle Leo and Uncle Robert in love? Remember Leo Hoechner, the family friend in Budapest? Art lover, dog breeder, snappy dresser, charismatic bachelor?
I would describe him as a Renaissance man. He was a very good athlete. His nickname was Tennis. His apartment was full of antiques and paintings. He was a great dancer. Women always wanted to dance with him. And he was a very good cook. He was so well-rounded. He was good at so many things. The word that kept coming up was genius.
This is Tom Agustin, Leo's great nephew. Leo also worked for Tom's father's family at the Kapesti textile factory in Budapest.
He was such a close member of the management team that he spent every Sunday having lunch with the family. So there was this side of Leo that was conventional. My mother also told me pretty directly that he was homosexual.
We don't know many details about Robert and Leo's relationship. Even before the Nazis came to Austria, it was prudent to keep such personal family details fairly private.
One of the tricky things about doing this kind of history is that people who were queer often were hiding that from a lot of the people in their life for their whole life. And if they left a paper trail, they would often destroy it.
But if you know what to look for, there are certain details that can catch the eye. Researchers at the LBI have found them listed next to each other as guests at an Austrian spa resort during the summer of 1934, and a letter to Elizabeth from a friend back in Vienna shares that he bumped into Robert and Leo together at the opera. And alongside boxes of salami sent to Elizabeth from Budapest were letters where Leo's concern for Robert's safety is clear.
July 1939. One is now so absorbed and worn down by daily worries that one loses the energy to imagine the future in the long term. The only bright spot was the day before yesterday, when Robert announced that after many nerve-wracking weeks, he had finally received his emigrant passport and thus had the opportunity to leave the country in a short time.
Leo wrote that he too hoped to be able to leave Hungary for England. But by March 1940, his plans changed.
The impression you got from Robert's letter that he intends to remain in England permanently is not quite correct. I had intended to divide my time between London and Budapest, and so I have always encouraged Robert to postpone the realization of his overseas plans. However, even if the war were to end soon, I do not consider the situation in Europe to be very promising, and it is quite possible that following this line of thought, I may also turn towards the United States. I hope it won't be too late by then.
It was too late. At Leo's insistence, Robert left for America, but before Leo could follow him, German forces entered Hungary in March 1944, 1 month before Robert died. It's possible that with communication cut off, the occupation of Hungary even spurred on Robert's desperate end. It's possible, too, that the tragic news didn't even reach Leo in Budapest. A reign of arbitrary terror was unleashed on the Jews of Budapest. Many were violently murdered or tortured. And eventually, they ordered any remaining Jews in Budapest into a tiny ghetto, unless they had protective papers.
My father ran out and ran to the Swedish embassy to get a Swedish passport, which we got. And that's really saved our lives.
Judith Brody remembers this harrowing time. Her parents were friends with Leo. Many Jews searched for hiding places and were aided by Swedish diplomat Raoul Wallenberg, who organized false papers and safe houses for them. These actions saved thousands of Jews. But there was someone else in the city, a local, also intent on saving as many people as he could.
We knew Leo during the summer of 1944. He had this wonderful apartment, and you could climb up. And there was a kind of an opening, and he was hiding people up there.
The entrance to Leo's secret chamber was hidden by one of his many antiques. No one would have suspected anything was behind it.
That apartment was a museum-type collection of antiques, artwork, paintings, and such.
He had a Madonna on his wall that if you took it down, there was a room, and he hid Jews there.
Tom and Kathy grew up hearing stories of Leo's bravery during the siege of Budapest and the lives that he managed to save.
He was able to go out in the streets and locate food, black market supplies, and brought it back and was able to feed not only himself, but these other 15-some people who were in that apartment hidden. So they did not starve.
And even though Leo couldn't fit Judith's family into his loft, he didn't forget about them.
We moved into a Swedish protected building. We had to do it just packing a few suitcases. So we didn't have much. Leo Hochner, he came and brought us food.
Somehow Leo had managed to find Judith's family a bag of almonds and a tub of goose fat. But that's not all.
He also got material in order to make himself a Nazi uniform, which he wore when he drove around Budapest. And people believed him. He pulled it off. I believe that it was quite obvious that he was gay, but I guess he was also very able to hide it. I guess when he put on an SS uniform and pulled his shoulders back, one had no idea.
Shockingly, Leo's masquerade wasn't restricted to public outings.
He had friends who were German soldiers or German officers, and he made it a point to entertain them in his apartment, even though he was hiding people who were very much at risk. My mother also told me the entertaining of German officers may have been also of a sexual nature as part of his ingratiating himself into that social strata, or that strata with the occupiers.
Now, this might all sound a little far-fetched, but as Elizabeth wrote in her memoirs, it's just the kind of guy Leo was, always full of surprises. He emerged from the siege of Budapest with one more surprise up his sleeve.
In our building, 1944, there was a couple called Berndorfer.
Alfred Berndorfer, a plastic surgeon, hid in Leo's attic during the siege with Vera, his wife.
But Vera was very friends with Leo, and eventually they got married.
After the war, when Loni, Paul, and Elizabeth traveled back to Europe, Kathy was able to meet Leo for the first time.
I remember him very much as a bon vivant. He had a sort of circle of hair around the outside and a shiny bald top. He had kind of a big nose. He had very sparkly eyes. And he was the kind of person that just attracted people to him.
Kathy and her family met Leo's new wife, Vera, as well.
She was quite attractive, beautifully dressed, and no one liked her. Not my grandmother, not my mother. I remember very little about her, other than she was very haughty, very arrogant.
But no one needed to wonder if Leo's relationship with Vera meant that he had forgotten about Robert. In 1944, just a few months after they married, Vera and Leo had a son.
There's a picture of Leo with Vera and Robert Hochner, the son.
It seems that Leo had named his son after Robert Bachrach.
I think Leo was lucky in his ability to survive. Robert was really unlucky. And as an American, I'm kind of horrified to read what happened to him. You know, America was a wonderfully welcoming country and society. But despite all the stories of immigrant successes, you don't hear, but I'm sure many stories exist of horror stories and really tragic stories like that befell Robert.
My grandmother and my grandfather felt very sorry and very sad about the way he died, that he died. They felt it was totally unjust. I heard about it for many years afterwards. Robert fled Austria, not only because he was a Jew, but because he was a homosexual. And he came to the Democratic Republic of the United States, which labeled homosexuals degenerates. And that's why he died. He never gave up on Leo Hochner. One of the awful tragedies of this story is that the end of the war was not that far away, and the likelihood that he could have seen Leo again was not that far away.
It's tempting to think that if Robert had survived, if New York City had been a friendlier place that lived up to its promise, that Leo and Robert might have been reunited after the war. It's tempting, but we can't know that. We know that Leo was still trying to join Robert in 1940, but we don't know what was in his heart in 1945, when he had a wife and a young child. We also know that Robert died thinking of Leo. And we know something else. We know that both of these men had friends who loved them who remember their kindness and their heroism and told their children and their grandchildren about them. And today, we remember them 80 years later.
The Elizabeth F. and Joseph Gay Family Collection in the archives of the Leo Beck Institute, New York, contains correspondence, photographs, and ephemera documenting the lives of the Feitler and Gay families in Austria and New York. Hidden among these documents are a small handful of letters from Robert Bachrach and Leo Hochner, including Robert's suicide note addressed to Loni Feitler. The entire collection can be viewed at www.lbi.org. Exile is a production of the Leo Beck Institute, New York, and Antica Productions. It's narrated by Mandy Patinkin. This episode was produced by Nadia Mady. Our executive producers are Laura Reger, Rami Tsabar, Stuart Cox, and Bernie Blum. Our associate producer is Emily Marantz. Research and translation by Isabella Kempf. Voice acting by Isabella Kempf, Rodrigo Fernandez-Stoll, Cyrus Lane, and Manuel Meyerhofer. Sound design and audio mix by Philip Wilson. Theme music by Oliver Wickham. Special thanks to Anna Lovovsky, Brian Furry, Hannes Sulzenbacher, Clarissa Hochner, and Diana Bollman. Thanks also to Victor Zadler, who wrote about Robert and Leo as part of LBI's literary project, Stolpertexte, and whose essay lent our episode its title and opening scene. This episode of Exile is made possible in part by a grant from the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany, which is supported by the German Federal Ministry of Finance and the Foundation Remembrance, Responsibility, and Future.